From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, immigration in the 2016 presidential race, Hillary Clinton's emails, China woe, women pass the Ranger test, and Jimmy Carter on life and cancer. Donald Trump puts out an immigration plan, build a wall, take away birthright citizenship, and, he says, deport millions. Here on Sunday with Chuck Todd.
So you're going to split up families.
Chuck.
You're going to deport children.
Chuck, no. We're going to keep the families together. We have to keep the families together.
But you're going to keep them together out.
But they have to go.
Hillary Clinton's email server continues to cause her headaches. She says it's nothing.
You were the official in charge. Did you wipe the server?
What, like with a cloth or something?
And two women passed the Army's Elite Ranger Training Program, graduating today. Captain Kristen Greist.
I'm definitely interested to see what new doors do open up for women. I think Special Forces would be something that I would definitely be interested in.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Lara Jakes from Foreign Policy, Lisa Desjardins from the PBS NewsHour, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see in Trump's immigration plan, Clinton's emails, the Chinese economy's big wobble? Joining us from Shirlington, Virginia, is Lisa Desjardins, political director at the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, good to be here.
And from Washington, Lara Jakes, deputy managing editor at Foreign Policy magazine. Lara, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Lisa, and Lara.
Let's listen to Donald Trump talking again this week. He talked a lot of things this week, birthright citizenship and deportation. But here it was the wall.
We're building a wall. It's going to be a wall that is not – nobody's going through my wall. Trump builds walls. I build walls. We're building a wall. It's going to be strong. It's going to be solid. It's going to be policed.
He wants to stop remittances until Mexico pays for that wall. Embargo Mexico if that's necessary to get them to pay. Build a fence. End birthright citizenship. Here was Jeb Bush saying on Tuesday, this just isn't serious.
To withhold remittances for people living here that are sending money back to their families, it's just not realistic. Creating an embargo on Mexico, our third largest trading partner, it's not realistic to suggest that you would do that. It's not realistic to create a fence in places where fences can't be built.
Lisa Desjardins, I'm looking here at the list of Republican candidates who are now leaning against birthright citizenship. It's got Santorum, Rand Paul, Ben Carson, Chris Christie, Lindsey Graham, even Bobby Jindal, who is a birthright citizen himself. Is Donald Trump now driving the GOP immigration bus?
There's no question about it. He is. But he's not the first one to come up with these ideas. These are ideas that have been in the party for some time. And in fact, when you talk about birthright citizenship, Tom, there was a House Republican hearing about this in April. There are bills in Congress about this. But he is the one owning the issue right now. And in the 2016 campaign, other candidates are working to catch up with him. It's going to be a fascinating to watch how these candidates try and get these primary voters by moving to the right, as they are doing right now on immigration. And then we'll see what happens. I think this is what Bush is getting at. When you get into the general election, most Americans right now, we are still thinking about this issue, want to retain birthright citizenship. We'll see if Trump moves the meter on that. But that's the general election. In the primary, Trump is speaking to a different crowd.
Lisa, step back here. What is happening? Yeah. Donald Trump's leading in the polls among Republicans. Do people still – you know, there was a lot of talk for months and months and months that this guy's a big talker. He was on The Apprentice. He's been all over media. Mm-hmm. But he will burn out. Is that still the talk?
It is still the talk behind the scenes, but I think that my approach to covering campaigns like this is you just can't make assumptions like that. I think that behind closed doors here in Washington, when you talk to sort of political minds, they all think that he probably will be done before Iowa. I'm not so sure. He himself is saying, I'm in this for the long haul. I'm not getting out. I think he is a real threat as an independent candidate as well if he doesn't get the Republican nomination. But I think the way I look at this, Tom, the way I know that he's being taken more and more seriously is reporters and other candidates are asking him the questions that you ask serious candidates, like how is his health? Could he make it as president? These are questions that you don't ask to candidates you're not taking seriously. And he's starting to get those questions. You know, I think it's impossible to predict predict what will happen with him, but I think that's the point. Some people are predicting that he's going to burn out. I honestly think we just don't know what's going to happen with him yet.
Real criticism coming his way on immigration and other areas from other candidates, but also agreement here with Scott Walker at the Iowa State Fair on Monday. Lots of action in Iowa this week. Scott Walker not getting as much attention as he may have anticipated there, but leaning toward Donald Trump on revoking birthright citizenship, the right of children born in this country to be American citizens. Walker seemed to agree.
Well, like I said, Harry Reid said that's not right for this country. I think that's something we should, absolutely, going forward.
We should end birthright citizenship.
Yeah, to me, it's about enforcing the laws in this country. And I think it's important to send a message that we're going to enforce the laws no matter how people come here. We need to uphold the law in this country.
Mark that, Jack Beatty. Scott Walker citing Harry Reid as his point of credibility on birthright citizenship. What about it, Jack? Where this immigration issue is going, where it's taking the GOP field?
Well, you know, it's taking it back to another place. In fact, I was looking for historical precedents for this, and I set limiting conditions based on three features of Trump's plan: its cruelty, its gratuitousness, and its scale. And I found one analog, and that is Operation Wetback. It was a roundup of Mexican laborers begun in 1954. It was cruel. In one incident, 88 deportees were left to die in desert heat. It was gratuitous. At least there was no war on against Mexico, as there was against Japan when FDR interned Japanese Americans. And it had scale, 1 million deportations in 1954 alone. But most of the targets lived along the Mexican border. Trump's targets live everywhere. Already, Mexican-American children are reportedly lumping Trump in with the nightmare figures of Mexican folklore, monsters that snatch families away, just like the police that Trump, speaking Wednesday in New Hampshire, boasted he'd unleash, his verb, on the illegals, his dehumanizing term for overwhelmingly law-abiding immigrant workers without papers.
Laura Jakes, you're watching this from a foreign policy point of view. It's been fascinating this week as we've seen all these Syrian refugees coming across from Turkey into the Greek islands. You've got vacationing people in these lovely surroundings and then boats filled to the gunnels with desperate refugees. And Germany, I think, saying they will take 800,000 of these refugees. And at the same time, we've got Donald Trump talking about deporting maybe 11 million out of the United States. How's the rest of the world looking at this American conversation now, Lara?
Well, they're very befuddled. I was in Rome last month, where immigration is a huge deal there as well. So many of the North African migrants are landing in Sicily and coming up through Italy, same as some of the Syrians are coming into the Greek islands and getting into Europe that way, or trying to pass through Europe in that way. And the Italians I spoke with were very flummoxed. They directly asked me, well, you know, how is it that the United States wants, you know, more people to come in? And we talk about this the plight of the migrants, and, you know, these people need to be able to escape oppressive governments, need to be able to escape war, need to be able to seek better lives, and yet you're not letting them in or you are letting them in, but you're trying to send them back to Mexico. The exact same thing is happening on your southern border. So in Europe, for example, it's a very state-by-state discrepancy. As you noted, Germany is being very welcoming to many of these migrants. At the same time, Macedonia this morning, the police on the border there with Greece were cracking down on some migrants trying to come into Macedonia. We still see all of the migrants who are in the Channel in Calais, France, trying to get into England, and they're being stopped as well. And, you know, these migration patterns happen. This is as old as the planet Earth, right? I mean, as long as there have been humans on Earth, there have been waves of migrants at different points over history, and we may be seeing some of that today. And there is no universal way to deal with it.
Though we've seen politics swinging to the right in Europe over this issue, some of those parties gaining new prominence as Europeans deal with this. It's not as if it's all a bed of roses there either on this front. It wasn't just immigration Republicans talking about this week. They had big conversations on health care, on education, and the Common Core. Here was Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal on Wednesday at the New Hampshire Education Summit in Londonderry attacking the Common Core.
Shouldn't you have the ability to go to your local school board, your local school, your local teacher, and say, hey, I agree or I disagree, I don't think this is the way you should be able to provide that input? You can't do that with Common Core. One of the rules is 85% of the content. We're only allowed to vary 15% of the content. Why do they think they're smarter than us?
But you had Ohio Governor John Kasich, who has stood up for Common Core, the only one who has, other than Jeb Bush, defending his position against a little bit of pushback from the audience.
But look, for me, I'm not going to change my position because there's four people in the front row yelling at me. I just don't operate that way.
Lisa, what about education policy here and the GOP? Is Common Core going down?
Among the Republican primary candidates, absolutely. I think that they're, as you say, John Kasich and Jeb Bush, the only two supporting Common Core. But I think that Common Core really suffers from a lack of understanding. A lot of these candidates, as you pointed out, are talking about they shouldn't force these standards on us. Well, who are they? They are actually a consortium of states that put these standards together. I think where there's probably a more substantial debate is over how much pressure the federal government puts on states to enforce these standards. But these are not federal standards. So in a way, it's a debate that perhaps doesn't move education policy in a real discussion way, but it's a political debate. And right now, Common Core is something that these candidates do not want to touch. But I think speaking to the bigger issue, Tom, a problem that we have this election is that we're not getting into these more substantial issues in the headlines right now. Trump is taking all the air out of the room. And we also saw this week two candidates talk about their health care reform plans, which deserve consideration. And they have criticisms and support. But those are things – those are major issues in this country, health care and education, that we're not paying attention to. Instead, we're talking about does Mexico pay for a wall? Do Mexicans pay for a wall? And even Trump's plan, I have to say, there are some details in Trump's plan that we're not talking about either. So we're hitting these headline issues. We're not talking about the fact that Donald Trump, for example, wants to stop green cards for a period of time. All green cards, and only allow employers to hire Americans. So these details we're not getting at this point.
We're talking education right here. We'll talk health care as well. But one wonders, do they not get the full workout now somehow in the Republican primary until Donald Trump has his say on it? Is he that potent as a showman or a politician right now? Lisa Desjardins with PBS NewsHour, please stand by. Lara Jakes at Foreign Policy, Jack Beatty. We're talking a week in the news. You can join us. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Trump's hard line, Hillary's email, China woes, stock market wobbles, and the first women Army Rangers. Let's bring our listeners in. Jose in Marietta, Georgia. Jose, you're on the air. What do you think?
This is all going through a third-party situation. I mean, there's no way that the Republican Party can use Trump in the forefront, so this is third-party stuff.
I mean, he ends up running on his own billion or billions as a third-party candidate a la Ross Perot?
Ross Perot garnered a lot more support than Trump did when he did it. I mean, Trump is going to fall apart as soon as he tries to do it because he only got support from one side mainly, just the Republican side. Perot had it from both sides. And his issue was not divisive. It was budget balancing stuff. Trump is so divisive, his third-party thing is going to fall apart. But, you know, we're going to just watch it happen.
But that's where it will go, you say, Jose. I appreciate your call. Lisa, what about the mechanics of this? If Donald Trump continues to have this kind of media grip and pull numbers, can the GOP somehow get around him anyway? Or is Jose right it's going to be a third-party candidacy if he goes forward?
I think Trump is the one who will decide that himself. I think his opponents are largely waiting for a major stumble, something that really undercuts him. But so far, he has been able to dodge a lot of bullets, and he's been able to say things, frankly, that I think if other candidates said them, it would bring them down. But it has helped him. He has that kind of strange magic dust that some few politicians have. But I think that said, I think Jose is right that if he does end up as a third-party candidate, that will erode his strength. I think that Republicans are serious about winning back the White House, and I think that while he will get some support, I think a lot of Republican voters will have trouble voting for a third-party candidate when they've been out of the White House for so long.
Let's look at other policy issues, other candidates. On Tuesday in Minnesota, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker unveiled his new health care plan, an alternative to Obamacare, which he says he would get rid of right away. Senator Marco Rubio also unveiled a health care alternative this week. Here's Scott Walker talking about his approach.
It's all about freedom. It's putting freedom back in the hands of patients and families to make decisions about your health care and about your money. We call it the Day One Patient Freedom Plan. And I want to walk through it with you this morning. As I mentioned, the first part is just repealing Obamacare entirely.
Step one, out with Obamacare. Jack Beatty, have you dipped into the day one patient freedom plan and where Scott Walker and, for that matter, Marco Rubio would take American health care? They both get rid of Obamacare.
Yes, the Walker plan has elements that are familiar from conservative think tank menus. Tort reform, block grants to states to fund Medicaid, expanded health savings account. It also has a novel element. To those without employer-paid health insurance, Walker would give subsidies, but they'd be based on age, not on income like Obamacare. Thus, a 30-year-old millionaire would be eligible for the same subsidy, about $900, as a 30-year-old Walmart cashier. That is certainly novel. Whether it's sensible or not, that's another question. And his nostrum, Walker's nostrum for containing cost, would be to permit consumers to buy insurance across state lines. That idea has little support among experts in the field who say insurers would gravitate to states with very little regulation. It's unclear how Walker would pay for his plan and keep his pledge to Grover Norquist never to raise taxes.
Lisa Desjardins, I'm reading here that the Walker plan, perhaps the Rubio plan as well, would in effect shift resources away from the poor, which were primarily helped by Obamacare, and toward the middle class. Does that seem like a reasonable analysis of what's going on here? And how does that work politically for a GOP candidate?
The Walker plan absolutely does shift resources away from the poor and spreads them out across all incomes. As Jack was saying, it doesn't look at people in terms of income, looks at them more in terms of age. But the Rubio plan actually does keep more resources with the poor. He continues tax credits for low incomes, though he hasn't really given exact details on how that would work. I think politically, Walker here is trying to say, I'm the man who's running against class policy, class politics. I'm someone who's trying to be above that. But the truth is, Tom, when I listened to that speech, here was the moment that Scott Walker was going to try and step up and be as much Trump or more Trump, smarter than Trump. Here's a serious man with a serious policy, and he's a man who can get things done. But he got very little applause. He did not have the kind of resonance in that speech that I think he needed. And he still is trying to find where he stands out again. He was the guy to beat for so long until Donald Trump entered the race, and he's having trouble getting back in that position. This plan has not done it. Some of his Republicans, including Bobby Jindal, have roundly criticized this plan as Obamacare light. Bobby Jindal said it sounds like he collaborated with Bernie Sanders. So, and if you look at it, really, that this plan, the idea of just repealing Obamacare on day one, I think most voters know that you need 60 votes in the Senate to do it. And it's naive to say that you can just do that by writing a letter, sending something to Congress.
Iowa was supposed to be Scott Walker's launching pad. Iowa State Fair wasn't much of a launch pad this week. Let's look on the other side of the political fence here. The Democrats, Hillary Clinton foremost. And this week, anyway, still with those emails kind of in her lap and giving her problems. On Tuesday, North Las Vegas, she pushed back against criticism that she was using her private email servers to send classified information.
Whether it was a personal account or a government account, I did not send classified material and I did not receive any material that was marked or designated classified, which is the way you know whether something is. What you're seeing now is a disagreement between agencies saying, you know what, they should have, and the other saying, no, they shouldn't. That has nothing to do with me.
Jack, what's going on here? You've got the FBI talking about looking at this, and maybe more. You've got a judge saying, I'm not so sure about this. Hillary and other Democrats looking to shake this off, and this is a distraction. Sure, a durable distraction so far.
It sure is. And since this surfaced in March, she has lost 25 points as against her lead over Bernie Sanders. And the trend seems to be down. You know, that really showed her at her worst. You know, the comment to Ed Henry, he said, you know, did you
wipe the server?
Yeah.
What do you mean with the cloth?
Yeah, come on. And I'm Queen Marie of Romania. In fact, her lawyer has stated that the server was wiped clean. You know, these press conferences really bring out the worst in Hillary, because she knows that, in the words of Politico's press watcher Dylan Beers, the national media have never been more primed to take down Hillary Clinton. Now, no one would write that about Joe Biden. In a poll out yesterday, he does better than Clinton in matchups against Trump in three swing states. The question of the hour in politics, will Joe run?
Will Joe run? I mean, I'm looking here, Chris Saliza, who writes for The Washington Post. The big headline is maybe Hillary Clinton just isn't a very good candidate. Is there serious grumbling within the Democratic Party, Lisa, that maybe somehow, in spite of all these years and the huge ramp and all the work she's put in, like it or not, even now, is the question mark over her that serious?
Within the Democratic Party, I would not call it that serious. I think there are many Democrats ruining the fact that I think, as Jack is saying, Hillary has a problem when she's a candidate. She does every single time. She runs into these issues, and part of it is what I think you could call a thin skin when she's dealing with these criticisms. Her campaign clearly feels this is not justified, that it's blown way out of proportion, but they're treating it that way, and it sort of raises more questions. I had a background conversations with one of her top aides last week. I was asking about the Bernie Sanders effect and how Bernie Sanders suddenly was in the lead in New Hampshire in one poll. And this source from the Clinton campaign said, well, you know, that's the Amtrak corridor where they care about things like emails. That's not Iowa where they care about things like higher ed. And it just struck me as such a telling remark that they were both kind of writing off, you know, Northeastern Corridor as caring about these political issues that don't really matter, and at the same time not really paying attention to something, being defensive without really addressing the real concerns Americans have, which are about trust. In the end, this story about the Hillary Clinton emails, including more stories today from Reuters, right now all we know is that it seems, at the least, Hillary Clinton was sloppy and took maybe some big risks with the information that she was using over emails. We don't know of anything illegal. We don't know of anything that she was hiding. But it just raises these questions about Hillary Clinton and the trust factor that go deep with voters, and she's not helping herself when she answers, as Jack says, with these kinds of tone in press conferences.
Bernie Sanders blowing right by all that at the Iowa State Fair on Sunday. Here talking about revolution.
If we are going to have a government that represents working families and not large campaign donors, we need a political revolution in this country. We need millions of people to stand up and make it clear to the billionaire class they cannot have it all.
They can't have it all. Casey in Nashville, Tennessee. Casey, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to point out that one thing that I find really interesting about Donald Trump, even though I don't think I would ever vote for him, is that he doesn't seem like a robot when he's on stage or when he's on the soapbox. He seems like a real person talking like from the heart, where the other candidates just seem like they're reciting exactly what they have to say on every issue.
And when he's real, by your lights, Casey, do you like what he actually has to say for policy? Is it something about his temperament, straightforwardness, as you say?
It's more about his temperament. I mean, I don't find myself agreeing with a lot of the stuff he says, yet there's this unpredictable nature that's attractive, that's like he doesn't seem like a robot.
Doesn't seem like a robot, and that's getting mileage with Casey. Casey, I appreciate your call very much. Let me get one more. Gabe, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gabe, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I was just going to say that, you know, I love Donald Trump. I really do. And the reason is because he's, he's ripping off the mask and crystallizing and making clear what's been driving the Republican Party for decades. And that's, you know, fear of the other and hate and racism and sexism. And he's not afraid to just go right for it. And he doesn't care if his suggestions are realistic. He just wants to say exactly what, you know, that base of the Republican Party wants to hear. So, to that degree, I think he's doing a great job. You know, if it gets out of control and he somehow wins, I think, you know, we're all in serious trouble. But, at the end of the day, this may actually help the Republican Party by, getting them to reflect and, you know, try to cut out some of this, real nastiness.
Gabe, you're breaking up, but I think we get the gist of it. I mean, in Boston this week, we saw two brothers beat a Mexican immigrant who was sleeping outside a subway station, urinated on the man, and said that they told police they did it in part inspired by Donald Trump. Jack, that's not a road the country wants to go down.
No, it's not. And, his effect upon his fellow candidates is equally deplorable. This week, Ben Carson, who's a surgeon, a man who saves lives, came out and suggested that, you know, one way to deal with these illegal immigrants is to strike at them with drones, you know, bomb Arizona. I just couldn't believe it. It's as if the Times put it, you know, kind of race to the bottom on this issue. And yet, you know, polls show that 50% of Republicans still favor comprehensive immigration reform. It's just that the 25% who are to whom that's an anathema are all gathered behind Trump right now.
We've got some big contexts surrounding a lot of the conversation in America this week. As those fires go on, we saw the hottest July in recorded world history, and projections it'll be the hottest year. Fires all over the place there. Economic front, China with big problems this week on display, and those came into the U.S. stock market, down 2% yesterday. Here was Nick Wadhams, Beijing bureau chief for Bloomberg News, talking about the big indicators now in the Chinese economy. Not so good.
Exports down, industrial production down, inflation very, very low, and money supply liquidity in the market shrinking as the government looks to really prop up the yuan. So, you know, when you sort of connect the dots, again, it's that the economic downturn looks to be more serious than people had thought.
Laura Jakes, we've talked about this, but here it goes down again. What is going on in China? They're in some kind of big swoon, and yesterday Wall Street was swooning right along with them. Is there a floor in sight?
Well, it's not clear. It may go up. I mean, this has been a very day-to-day process over the last 2 weeks. People have been watching it. It's important to note that historically China has kind of manipulated its currency value almost every day, but by very small amounts. What caused this to happen a week ago was that they are trying to let market forces guide their currency. They're doing this because they want to be included within the International Monetary Fund's elite group of worldwide currencies, which means the yuan or the renminbi will be used more frequently across the world. Mm-hmm. And so they have set a more you know, stable – they're trying to set a more stable value for their currency. But it really has tanked the market. And the reason for that is because the Chinese economy has been decreasing steadily over the last year. As the Bloomberg person pointed out, exports are down. You know, housing markets are down. Construction is down. And that means that, you know, there's fewer money – that's fewer imports that are coming into China. And it could lead to a depression at some point if there is no floor.
I mean, we saw Wall Street responding yesterday. Countries who have for years poured natural resources, commodities into China to feed that big manufacturing machine, facing their own difficulties. Here over the weekend in Brazil, huge demonstrations there. This is one man protesting for the impeachment of the president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, talking about corruption in his country, too.
I'm 55 years old and always saying that Brazil is the country of the future. And this future never comes. And with corruption, it will be much more difficult.
Laura Jakes, Brazil's political stability another casualty of China's troubles? Or is this homegrown with their corruption scandal around the oil company there and more?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, this is one of those situations where foreign policy is really economic policy. We can talk about that with Greece as well. I mean, Brazil is one of the emerging markets in the world. And so, yes, it has been affected by some point by China. But one might say that China's been affected by emerging markets because like Brazil's, because Brazil is able to import and export at a much lower value than China was, which is one of the reasons why China lowered the value of its own currency. Regarding the corruption that's happening in Brazil right now, I mean, as you know, the president, there have been calls for her impeachment. And just recently, in the last few hours, the Speaker of the Brazilian House was arrested on corruption charges. He's the one who is calling for the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff. So who's to say where this is going to go? They're both pointing fingers at each other, and we're just going to have to wait to see how it shakes out there.
We've got a lot to look at. Laura Jakes, please stand by. Lisa Desjardins, Jack Beatty. We're looking at a week in the news. Are you watching Brazil, Greece, Bangkok, that flood of Syrian refugees? What are your thoughts on Jimmy Carter this week? This is On Point. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the hottest global July in history and the U.S. military now deployed as historic wildfires rage in the West. Washington State Governor Jay Inslee yesterday called it a cataclysm.
This is an unprecedented cataclysm in our state. There are 390,000 acres burning.
Former President Jimmy Carter, at 90, came very public yesterday about the cancer that has spread to his brain. He said he was at peace with his diagnosis.
I've had a wonderful life. I've had thousands of friends, and I've had an exciting and adventurous and gratifying existence. So I was surprisingly at ease, much more so than my wife was.
We'll look at more of what he had to say. And the biopic Straight Outta Compton about pioneering rap group N.W.A. was number one at the box office.
Straight Outta Compton.
With too much relevance, maybe, as we saw more protests and shooting in the streets in St. Louis this week. We're talking about a week in the news, Trump's hard line on immigration, Hillary's email, and Bernie Sanders, China woes, stock market wobbles, the first women Army Rangers getting their tabs today in Fort Benning, Georgia. Listeners responding online here, G. Welch quoting Donald Trump, I build walls. Listener writes, I would rather have a president that built bridges and roads and schools. If Donald might say he builds all of that, a bunch of Americans maybe thinking that wall sounds good right now if Donald Trump's poll numbers are any indication. 800-423-8255. Let's go to Richard in Duke Center, Pennsylvania. Richard, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to talk about women in the infantry or artillery. Yes, I'm all for it.
You've seen these two graduates. They were speaking out yesterday of Army Ranger School. That is a very, very tough training and testing course. The Pentagon has already said women in combat, they're going to be cleared except for positions that are held exempt, and they're deciding what those will be now. Women in combat, fine by you, Richard?
Oh, yes, definitely. Women are much better shots than guys. I hate to tell you that, guys, but they are. I spent 34 years in the United States Army to prove it.
And at the front, is it awkward or it's just okay? It's the way it is, having both
okay.
Genders.
If they can do the job, they're there.
Richard, I appreciate your call. Lisa Desjardins, who we've got Captain Kristen Greist out of Orange, Connecticut. We've got First Lieutenant Shea Haver out of Copperas Cove, Texas. They passed after all that. Lots of people washed out. Lots of women washed out. Lots of guys washed out. It is rough as it can be. And big decision coming from the Pentagon about exactly where combat positions will or maybe will not be opened.
You know, I'm a military kid. My dad's a former Navy captain, and I watch so many news conferences. I know Laura and Jack, all of us, we watch way too much news. Probably our listeners watch too much news. But I have to say that news conference yesterday with those women and the men who they went through Ranger School with was extraordinary. And it was impressive for them and for the men. All of the men, one by one, said they came in with a little skepticism. The women said they did, too, about how they'd be treated, and that they all left as a unit. And the men said that the women really kind of in some ways outperformed the men in that the women more routinely volunteered to take on weight, to help their colleagues through these tough, grueling situations. And it was just very matter of fact, no one trying to extol themselves too much, but these tremendous accomplishments on both sides. It was really an extraordinary moment, and I think an extraordinary moment for the military right now.
It was.
If I could
impressive.
Jump in here.
Yes, please,
really
Laura. Yes, please.
Just some of the military people I talked to, active duty soldiers, officers, enlisted people, they really feel like this is no big deal, that this is more of an issue that's made of outside of the military. If, just like Lisa said, just like the caller said, if the people who are doing the task can do it, get it done, account for themselves, account for their battle buddies, it doesn't matter if they're black, white, man, woman, gay, straight. Really, these are things that the military internally, the people who are doing the missions – don't seem to have a lot of problem with. And I've talked to a lot of soldiers, both overseas, here in the Pentagon. I have some family ties with people in the military as well. It just doesn't seem like that big of a deal. And the people I've talked to in the military are very, very proud of these two women.
But it has been a big deal, Jack, with longstanding prohibitions on women in combat formerly, though, in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Without clear front lines, women were very, very often put into positions of combat, top gunners in Humvees and a whole lot more. But they couldn't formally do it, so they couldn't formally hold those positions, so they couldn't formally advance in the military in the way that combat is always undergirded advancement.
It undoubtedly put a cap on their ambitions. And, you know, yes, indeed they served. Look at Tammy Duckworth, now running for the Senate in Illinois, House member, lost both legs in a helicopter crash, shot down in Iraq. And that's emblematic of the kind of suffering that women have already endured in combat.
Dylan in Austin, Texas. Dylan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, Army Rangers are born to be fighters, so I don't see why there's any reason that they shouldn't be allowed to fight. I mean, that is kind of foolish to me. A Ranger is a Ranger regardless of gender.
Of course, the first thing you have to do is become a Ranger, and until this summer, this year, I should say, women had never even been part of the Army Ranger test, the Army Ranger course. If you don't take the course, you can't be a Ranger. Rangers appear to be open to this. Navy SEAL leaders have said they're open to it, even there, though that test is even harder. We'll see how that goes. Marines, not so sure about this. Lots of decisions to be made here within the services by the end of this year, and then we'll see where it goes. 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. I want to ask just briefly about Bangkok, Thailand, if I can, Lara Jakes. We all saw that huge explosion there earlier this week, and it's not a scene that we think of as a setting for terrorism. Here was sound of, this is a motorbike taxi driver. They've got motorcycles you can hop on. Terasak Kultum describing the scene here, interpreted by CNN.
I hadn't parked for a minute. I heard the blast. I turned back to look at where the sound came from and saw people scattered on the streets everywhere. I decided to abandon my bike and ran off to the other side. I've never been through anything like this before. I'm still scared.
Terrible bombing in the temple there. 20 dead, Lara. Officials saying they think it was a foreign bomber, but most fingers are not pointing abroad. It doesn't, at least not so far, not ISIS. Is there a trail of any kind that leads to a group, an interest at work here?
Well, the composite, you're right, showed no kind of indication of any kind of nationality. It was a very vaguely drawn composite. The video shows a man with a yellow shirt that led to some conspiracy theories. Yellow shirts in Thailand are known as kind of political opposition to the kingdom. But we've seen no evidence so far that indicates anything about a motive, anything who this person was, these people were. Two people were questioned overnight and have been released in connection with this. They've been cleared. But you're absolutely right that this was a shocking thing to happen in downtown Bangkok. It happened in an area that's kind of informally known as the Times Square of Bangkok. The shrine is a huge tourist draw in that area. And, you know, we'll just have to see where this goes.
I spent plenty of time right in that area, and it was remarkable to see Bangkok facing it. And then a second bombing down by the river there. Let's hope they get all of that straightened out. St. Louis with problems in the streets this week. A young man killed by police said he was wielding a gun, and down he went. There were protests. 9 were arrested. A lot of tear gas being fired. Demonstrators gathered after the shooting of Mansour Balbay, 18 years old. They said he pointed a gun at them. Here's some video shot by a bystander as police went down the street, really letting go with the tear gas.
Police are driving down the street shooting tear gas where kids are.
They are shooting it on residential streets.
They are shooting. These people are actually standing here not doing a thing, and they are shooting this into where their cars are and kids are taking shelter.
Jack, where's this going? We're not back in Ferguson this week, but just next door in St. Louis, and it's been the drumbeat all through this year. Do we see policy, understanding, something rising up to meet this issue in the streets, or does it just go on?
We certainly hear indignation. We certainly hear informed comment. We certainly hear in white voices discovery. My God, I didn't realize it was this bad in terms of the violence against young black men and not just them. Do we see much progress? I don't know. The Missouri legislature, for example, did something, but they didn't do enough. There were bills they didn't touch that would have dealt with broader issues coming out of Ferguson. And facts remain as they are. Ferguson's high school apparently is ranked the worst out of, I don't know, several hundred in the state of Missouri. That's how bad it is. So those structural problems of inequality in black America remain, and it's an inequality in life chances, in education, and also in just surviving the day.
Hillary Clinton and other candidates have taken really tough questioning on this front. In Clinton's case, about when she was in the White House with her husband, then President Bill Clinton, and the crackdown on crime, and a lot of money put toward new jails, prisons. Black Lives Matter activist Julian Jones talked with her in Keene, New Hampshire last week. The video just came out on Monday. It's a little long, but it's really interesting to see how focused this young man's questions for her are.
I genuinely want to know, you and your family have been, in no uncertain way, partially responsible for this, more than most, right? Now, there may have been unintended consequences, but now that you understand the consequences, what in your heart has changed that's going to change the direction of this country? Mm-hmm. Like, what in you, like, not your platform, mm-hmm. not what you're supposed to say, like, how do you actually feel that's different than you did before? Like, what were the mistakes, and how can those mistakes that you made be lessons for all of America? For a moment of reflection on how we treat black people in this country.
There, a really pointed question. Hillary Clinton kind of skating away from the issue of Clinton policy in the 1990s on crime and punishment. But she did say that she doesn't believe you can change hearts. She said, I believe you change laws, she told this young man from Black Lives Matter. You can change allocation of resources. You change the way systems operate. You're not going to change every heart. You're not. Lisa, what effect does this close questioning and sometimes just interruption and catcalls right. from Black Lives Matter having on the race conversation on the campaign trail?
I think this conversation was the intersection of two huge question marks over America right now. One is what America thinks of Hillary Clinton. The other is how America handles, as Jack said, this discovery, especially for white America, of what has been profound and long problems between police and African Americans to an extent that I think has not been addressed. And what happened in this conversation, I think, for Hillary Clinton on the political end is I think she did not win over a lot of African American support in this. I think those, if you look on Twitter, the young kind of activists involved in this movement felt that she really was not answering their questions, felt that, you know, that she was almost dressing them down and not taking them seriously. I think from her perspective, she was trying to say to them, you need a very clear agenda. You need very clear issues. What they were trying to tell her is that they feel they have been let down by leaders like her in the past who didn't really think about their communities, even as they were talking about their communities.
Is so the GOP getting these questions, Lisa?
Yeah.
Are Republicans
The GOP is absolutely getting these questions, but not to the extent that Democrats are. There definitely is a different standard, I think. But I think that's
And why is that? Because Black Lives Matter wants blacks have overwhelmingly voted Democratic. They want more, responsive Democratic policy?
Right. I think Democrats have been more closely connected with the African-American community. I think that shows out in how African-Americans vote. That shows in how Democrats reach out. But I think we're seeing that start to change just a little bit with some candidates like Rand Paul trying to spend more time with African-American communities. Ben Carson has a lot to say. He himself growing up in a poor single mother household and trying to be an example for what he thinks should be the future. But I think that right now the Black Lives Matter movement is trying to get attention on all fronts. And I think they don't feel like candidates like Hillary Clinton, who have been around for several generations, understand what they're saying.
I want to touch just once more on Jimmy Carter moving there. He was so on yesterday at 90 with cancer. Here he was saying that his religious faith gave him comfort after his diagnosis.
I was pleasantly surprised that that I didn't go into an attitude of despair or or anger or anything like that. I was just completely at ease. I've just been very grateful for that part of it. So I'm ready for anything and looking forward to a new adventure.
Lord Jakes, this is an ex-president who has had impact all over the world and in many years since he lived in the White House. And what an image of him, so sprightly, even as he talked about what could well be deadly cancer there.
I completely agree. He was dapper. He was engaging. He had that trademark kind of disarming smile. He spoke very lucidly about a range of topics. I mean, most of the reporters there asked him about how he was feeling and his health prospects. But he wanted to talk a little bit about Iran, and he wanted to talk a little bit about how he felt that if he had to do it all again, he would have sent in another helicopter in 1980 to try and rescue the hostages from Tehran. He spoke a little bit about the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. I felt that, you know, I feel the exact same way you did. You had to kind of smile when you were watching that press conference.
Hats off and hearts go out to Jimmy Carter this week. Laura Jakes at Foreign Policy Magazine, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Lisa Desjardins at PBS NewsHour, thanks to you, Lisa.
You're welcome.
And thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
We talked this week about hip-hop, rap, and politics in the era of Black Lives Matter. Our guest Bakari Kitwana recommended this new release, The Babies, from rapper Jasiri X. We leave you with it. There's a link to the full song and video at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Imagine babies being born with a black mask and a bullseye birthmark on our black head. While Officer Loman shot to mirror that fast, 400 years of fear appeared in the gap blast. They ain't tell us we be murdered by the policia. Ooh, child, they said things were gonna get easier. They ain't tell us we be crucified in the media. Turned into a hashtag highlights on Wikipedia. The rich get greedier, the poor more needy. Of a hood seedier, lock us up instead of freeing us. Who speaks for us? We ain't listening when you preach to us. So concerned when we can only learn what you're teaching us.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.